Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording. And today, this particular episode here is episode, I think, number four today. It seems like I've been recording this back to back today. So this particular episode is episode 136, since I started the Localization Fireside channel. And I am honored and I have the distinct pleasure to have with me Stephen Clark. Stephen and I, we've been talking a few times already, and we plan to have a podcast together. And the reason I wanted to do the podcast with Stephen, because the conversation that we've had is very interesting. It is not necessarily a conversation, the Localization Fireside Chat. This is the first time I'm having this type of conversation, to be honest. It's about giving back to the community. It's about doing charity. It's about doing good to others. And Stephen has found a unique model to do this. And it was so intriguing when he described the model to me. I thought, why don't we do a podcast on this one so we can explain how he does this to the rest of the world. And what I mean by the rest of the world is we are about 1,200 downloads per day right now on this channel. So hopefully somebody will listen to this message, today's cause that Stephen and I were going to target, and hopefully will stir up something inside of somebody to reach out to Stephen and to his team and engage with them in doing something better for the community and the world that they live in, and we all live in. Stephen, welcome to the channel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for taking the time and being with me. Stephen, it's a pretty relaxed conversation. Just relax. You and I are having coffee. Pretend we're having coffee at Starbucks, shooting the breeze, and we are recording a podcast in the meantime. That's the best way to record these things, in my opinion. So I know you mentioned hockey before we started the recordings. From athlete to entrepreneur, walk me through the journey. I'd love to hear your story.
It's an interesting one. A lot of people don't quite understand the transition of that. Athletes, a very difficult transition for a lot. And I'll tell you why. It's really got to do with ego. Athletes, as many people know, professional athletes have pretty big egos. What they don't know is that it's kind of a necessity. You know, first of all, you're surrounded with people all the time are telling you how great you are. But secondly, it's kind of part of the job. You have to believe that, because you're fighting for your job all the time, especially back in the day when I played. So that transition is difficult often, because now you go from kind of an immortal to just a regular person. For me, it was rather sudden. I got hurt badly. And after six surgeries, that was it. I just basically couldn't. I was only 25. I played 5 years. And that was the end of it. So it was a very difficult transition for me, but I was fortunate enough to be introduced to a new industry, which was the advertising world. And that was so exciting. I loved it. And so I was able to really transition very quickly into that and kind of move on, naturally move on, not have to think about all the stuff that I'd missed and everything like that. But it is for most a difficult transition. I think I was one of the lucky ones and found a new career right away, which ended up being a real career of over 25 years. So that's kind of how it worked for me. As I say, I was one of the lucky ones.
So when you played hockey, I think it was hockey, right? That's
yes, what it was. Yes, right? I was a professional hockey
player. Who did you play for? What was your position?
I was, first of all, I modeled my game after Bobby Orr, who I still think it was the greatest that I ever played. And so I was a rushing defenseman. I went and played, rather than playing the minors, where when you get drafted and signed a contract, that's where they put you back then anyway. So I went to the Swedish NHL, the Swedish Elite League it was called back then. And I went there honestly too, because the Swedish players that were coming here, still are coming here, are obviously superstars. And so I wanted to play against that level, which I wasn't going to get in the minors. So I went there and ended up signing a deal on my fourth year over there with the Vancouver Canucks, and then coming back here, that's when I got hurt, and then it was just after six surgeries, it was like you're not going to be able to play anymore. So it was like that. So the majority of my career was spent in Europe, in Swedish Elite League, but more importantly, all over Europe. So I got to play in Russia and Czechoslovakia. It was a real experience, and as I said, the hockey was great.
Do you speak Swedish?
I'm fluent in Swedish.
Great.
Yes.
Because I did my, and it's very interesting, I did my first podcast today, a bilingual podcast, where I was speaking English and the guest was speaking Spanish.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Yeah, no, I decided to learn, because when I first went over there, people were screaming and hollering at me, of course, on the ice, and I didn't know what they were saying. And so, you know, I had to go over to the bench and ask the guys, well, what did he say? And when they told me, I wasn't too pleased about it. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to stay here, I think it's a good idea to learn it. So I actually went to school during the day to learn it.
Oh, you did a professional learning? Like you went to school?
I went to the Stockholm University. I went to actually take it because I wanted to learn it quickly. I mean, I was immersed there, but you know, you learn it some way. But I wanted to learn. I wanted to be able to be able to read, write the whole bit. So I did that because I had some time during the day, of course, playing.
Absolutely.
So I could kind of pick and choose my places. So I learned it very quickly. So, you know, by the end of the first year, I was pretty good at it. And then it just got better from there. So.
Well, good for you. And you know what? This talks about how people immerse in themselves in other cultures.
Yeah.
And, you know, like a lot of times people refuse to do that. For those who, you know, go with the flow and immerse themselves in the culture, there's a lot of benefits to that. You learn another another culture. You open eyes on various things.
For sure. I'll tell you something else, Robin. For me, I've always done this, and maybe it's my upbringing. My mom was pretty special person. But no matter where I'm going, I will learn words from that language. The obvious ones: please, thank you, you know those things. And so, you know, I can say that in many languages. Whenever if I'm visiting a country, wherever it is, obviously, we visit a lot of Spanish countries, so I can speak quite a few words in there, but I just think it's, I mean, we're in their country. I mean, let's respect it a little bit. Let's at least be able to converse with them a little bit and let them know that
100%.
We're thankful. So, yeah, I've been doing
it. Now, moving to the professional side of your life, if you contemplate back, if you reflect back and you say, okay, so I am an entrepreneur, your successful business, a professional, you've been doing this for many years. How does your professional athlete world helped you in your business profession?
Yeah, that's a question that all athletes get. And it's usually they'll say, the typical answers are, well, you know, I was disciplined as an athlete. You can't be a professional athlete without being disciplined. And so I learned all those things. The reality is, in true, as I've learned over time, actually, aside from those traits, which a lot of people have, you don't have to be a professional athlete to be disciplined and things like that. What we do learn to work on our weaknesses. All professional athletes are taught to work on their weaknesses. That is the total opposite of how you become successful in business. And I was taught that by the great Stephen Covey. First one I ever heard him tell me when I was talking to him and I was having breakfast, and I ended up working with him for years as him being my mentor and just a friend. But he said to me in the very first meeting, he said, you know, if you really want to take your business, my business at that time, you know, was less than 2 years. And he said, if you really want to take it to the next level, you're going to have to learn something, and it's going to be difficult for you because you were a professional athlete. And that's that you need to find something that you really love to do and that you're good at, and then surround yourself with people who love to do what you hate. Well, that's the anti, you know, athlete type of thing. It was like, what? Explain that one to me again. And so him and I worked on that. It took about a year. And then because, of course, I'm fairly new. My first 4 years after leaving hockey, I worked for a big advertising company, and then I started my own. And so I had to learn all this, and it was like, wow. I mean, I was doing everything, you know, making sure I was overseeing everything. We were a small company back then, but I knew we were going to be growing. And so that was a whole thing I had to learn, and it worked out so well for me in all the other careers that I've had, especially now with what I'm doing. So it was... you learn these things. So it's kind of good and bad. We learn some great things, obviously, in athletics about life in general. But when it comes to business, it's kind of the, you know, it's the total opposite of what they teach you as an athlete.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let's move a little bit to RTG, which is the group that you in charge of, that you work with, and you've built block by block. For those who are listening, what is RTG Group of Companies? In simple terms, like what do you do?
Yeah, RTG Group, which stands for Receiving Through Giving, something that my mother drilled into me. RTG is a for-profit social enterprise, and it was created almost 10 years ago now out of the need for me to make a positive impact in the world. And the way I did that, because at that point in time, I'd spent 20 some odd years in advertising. So we got all the information. We hired a research team and got all the information we could get from the charity nonprofit world in both Canada and the United States. And then we went through it. And then we, piece by piece, we went through that data. We looked at it. We figured out how, you know, what we wanted to do and how we wanted to do it. And we realized that if I truly wanted to make a positive impact in the world, I had to create a new model. It wasn't going to be about just continuing the way things are have already been done, because quite frankly, we're not getting things done. You know, we're not, the numbers aren't going down. The homelessness, hunger, mental health, I mean, all these different things. And the model is not really built to eliminate these problems. It does a lot of good, and I'm not knocking the model, but it's not built to eradicate these causes. And so I said, well, that wasn't what I wanted. And as a creative business strategist that had built, you know, models and programs for some of the biggest companies in the world, I certainly could build my own. And so that's what we did. We found out the three key components that we had to, that our whole model had, the three pillars that the model had to rest on. And then we just built from there, and we built a number of different companies. And so that's how we ended up getting to where we are now. This is obviously a new chapter in my life for me, but it may be the last one, because I just love doing it and I can't see myself doing anything else.
You know, receiving through giving, Stephen, what a concept. Like, it's it's an absolute, and you know, my family always drilled that into me as well.
Yes.
Maybe we come from the same background, I don't know, with that sixth degree of separation.
Yeah.
Maybe working.
Yeah, it could be. We were very poor. And that was the funny thing that my mom.
Oh, same here. I mean, I don't come from a rich family by any means.
Exactly. So we had nothing. And so she kept telling me that. And of course, back then I kept saying to her, yeah, well, wait till I get something. And then I can do it after I can receive it after I give it. But I had nothing to give. But it certainly hit me, especially when I signed my first hockey contract. And then from there on in, it was like, I understand it clearly. So it was very easy when my wife and I, we were saying, okay, what should we, you know, you're going to build a new company, what are you going to name it? Right away, I said RTG Group. And even she said, what does that mean? I said, it means receiving through giving. And unfortunately, both of my parents, I'd lost them a few years before I started this. And so they didn't get to see, you know, what it's come. Although I'm sure they're looking down and smiling.
They're looking down on you and they're smiling.
Yeah.
One of the things that you mentioned, which is very true, is with all the giving that's happening out there, we have not yet solved many of the major problems that we're facing as a society in any part of the world. Hunger, homelessness, you mentioned a few, et cetera. And you and I were talking in a previous conversation where you mentioned to me that there is a financial metrics that doesn't make sense in the traditional giving versus the model that you created. Could you walk us through the differences?
Sure. I think that first of all, I mean, the fundamental differences is like anything else. It's a for-profit versus non-profit. People don't understand exactly how these models were built and the limitations placed on them. So I'll give you a couple of examples. In the United States, that's where we kind of started this. We're just bringing it to Canada now. But when we look like today, like, well, last year in the United States, they were given there's 1.8 million charities and nonprofits in the United States, and they were given $1.5 trillion, not one cause going down. So you say, well, why not? Well, the first thing is they employ over 13 million people. That's over 800 billion right there. That's over 50% just in what they're in the employment. So, and by the way, to me, as just a regular business guy, I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, who's going to criticize somebody who's employing over 13 million people a year? I mean, that's a good thing. And the ones who definitely agree with me on this one is the government. They're all for the employment, right? So they're not going to say anything about it.
Employment taxes.
Exactly. They get taxes. They don't have to look after those people. They've all got jobs. They stimulate the economy. But there's fundamentally other huge flaws. So, for example, the corporate world. So you would think that the corporate world, especially thinking in America and the companies in America, right? You know, the Amazons, Apples, all these companies, those companies of the 1.5 trillion, those companies are giving $30 billion a year. That's it, $30 billion. That's it of the 1.5 trillion. The reason they're doing that is twofold. Number one, they max out because the government, like in Canada, we have a max that you can give based on your after-tax profit or before-tax profit. So you max that out, and that's what they give. And they're not going to give after-tax profit. They're just not going to do that. But when you look at it and you say, well, how else can we get them to contribute? Well, that was the industry that I spent over 20 years in. That's the marketing. Those same companies that give $30 billion a year, they spend $500 billion a year in marketing. So that was perfect for me because I can't, as a for-profit, I can't touch the $30 billion anyway. They want tax receipts. But I can create a model that gives them not only a return on their investment or their marketing spend, but a return on impact. And that's why we have the number one marketing program in the United States, right? So that's what we can do. We can tap into, and this for-profit model can tap into. What about the largest financial industry in the world? Well, it's called the financial industry. Go and ask a VC how many charities or nonprofits they invest in. And after they finish laughing, they'll say, what are you talking about? How could we invest in a charity or nonprofit except to get a tax receipt? There's not the returns. And I'll tell you exactly what they said, because I heard this many times. You don't think that that money's ours, do you? We invest other people's money, right? So we have to invest that money so that we get returns that could pay them the returns and we can still get ours. So we will never invest in the charity nonprofit space. So why would I want to eliminate the largest financial community in the world? So that's why I became a for-profit. And that's why now in our model, where VCs are now looking at, we provide a 15% annually compounded. And that was the number I got from them. So now they can invest. They can get 15% per year compounded. They can give their people returns. They can keep some themselves. And all of a sudden they're investing in companies that are doing good, or at least one anyway. There was many factors that created this model, and but they fundamentally it went in so that we could provide full transparency. You know, people are looking for that now, and I predicted this 8-9 years ago, and now they're starting to demand it. So you want to provide, where's my money going? What's the impact? Extremely important. You want to build a model. Everybody should want to build a model about around sustainability. You want it to keep going, right? Well, in the charity world, on average, people give $50 a month for less than 4 years. That's not sustainability. So then they have to keep replacing them. That's crazy. Every year, the number one thing that charities and nonprofits do, raise money. They just go through it. It's terrible. So sustainability was important. And then the last one, which again, doesn't really exist in the space, is collaboration. Are we stronger together? Of course we're stronger together. That's a ridiculous statement. But they don't work together, because we know why. They're all going after the same grants and donors. So it's like, hey, I love what you're doing, but stay away from me. So we took all of this to create what we've got now. And that's why it's starting to really take off.
You basically took the model, practice model, and you turned it upside down, I believe, if I can draw a picture for that one.
Yeah, we
did. The current model is very traditional model. I collect money from donors, and I keep some, and I take some to the end user, whoever the end user is. However, that piece of the pie is shrinking by all metrics. Mm-hmm. And what you did is you took that model and you flipped it around and said, okay, I got to think about this differently. And mm-hmm. by thinking differently, meaning that I'm going to take more of that piece of the pie and send it to the end user. And I know you and I talked about few examples of those. What was the impact on the end user, on the receiving end of the charity?
Well, first of all, we create a lot of our own model. So in our homeless model, for example, we saw many of the flaws there. And we know, I mean, in Toronto, for example, in 2021, we had 7,800 people living on the streets of Toronto. And in 2024, the end of last year, we had 15,600 people living in the streets of Toronto. That's double. That's over double. So what's
going on? So we're not solving anything big, right?
No, we're not. As it gets worse and more people come in, even if they're taking, 1,000 people off, well, there's 1,500 people going back on. So it's just a vicious cycle. And you have to come up, the problem with, as a strategist, and this is where really I kind of, as a creative business strategist, so that's how I can strategically build the models, but make them creative so that they actually work. And so as that, I looked and said, okay, I want to do a program like our homeless program. So the homeless program right now, every city in North America will tell you the same thing. We're building affordable housing. Oh, it's a lack of affordable housing. Wow. It's amazing to listen to that, where the reality is that, subsidized housing is really the solution. That's what we do. And we make sure through subsidized housing that those people stay off the street. We make sure also that we provide in our program job training and guaranteed jobs. So they are going to stay off the street. They're now being assimilated back into society and given responsibility, given hope. So, you know, there's so, I mean, it's so detailed. What we do is really simple, but the how we got here really took a lot of time. I mean, years of changing it and course correcting and tweaking it. And I mean, even with the food, we had to make sure that you know, full transparency about where it's going, where they're getting it, all these different things. But we do, I can tell you, we partner with a lot of local people too in the different cities who are doing great things. So it's just really been a fun thing. I think you're going to see it now that we've kind of received, we're at that point now of acceptance. Now it's going to explode. Now you're going to see something really special over the next few years.
You know, for the worthy cause that you guys are, you know, taking on, you and your wife, Svetlana, which I had the opportunity to talk to. And by the way, for the audience, I'll connect you with both Stephen and his wife, Svetlana. She's involved in the Immigration Women Entrepreneurs of Canada. Very, very active supporting young immigrants coming to the country, getting them settled, finding jobs. I can't speak highly enough of both of this couple here. The work they do is amazing. And this is not supported by government by any chance. Like, I don't want people from outside Canada listening in onto this conversation to think government of Canada's got a finger into this. No, they don't. And this is a self-sustained model that Stephen is talking about. I take from the community, from the donors, and I reinvest it back and I give back to people. This is the way we need more of that. I think the other models have failed. I think we need to mushroom this into multiple.
Yeah. I think that the reality is this, again, as a strategist, I looked at this and said, okay, here is the harsh reality. It's not going to change. The models that we have right now for charities and nonprofits, they're not going to change. And they're not going to change because of what I already told you. The governments are behind them because of the number of people they employ.
Well, it's hard-coded in a tax system. I mean, how can they change
exactly. it? Exactly. And there's, again, there's many reasons for that. I mean, if they say in Canada, well, you employ over 3 million people. If you only employed maybe half of that, then more money could go and we might be able to start to reduce some of those causes. But then they look in the mirrors and say, what's going to happen to those other 1.5 million people who don't have jobs now? And by the way, whose responsibility they are? Wait a second, they're ours, the government. Okay, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we should just keep doing what we're doing and hopefully they'll work it out. So the reality is that we need to work together. Our model is built. The one real sneaky thing about our model is the third pillar. And when we're introducing this to more and more charities who are adamant that they're not going to work with us, by the time we get to that collaboration part, they're like, whoa, hang on a second. What? Yeah, exactly. Your volunteers can actually make you more money by doing our cause, and we can legally incentivize your volunteers because we're not a charity or nonprofit. We don't fall under the rules that both Canada and the U.S. governments propose. We can do anything. It's our money. So all of a sudden, we're going to bring back volunteerism now. Because remember, if you're a volunteer, think about it, Robin. You're out volunteering, and you raise $12,000 for diabetes, and you give them. And then you find out that of that $12,000, there's probably about $7,000 or maybe even more going to pay wages. But the government says that the guy who raised it, me, the volunteer, is not legally allowed to take a dime. Say, wait a second, this isn't what I signed up for. So now we built this problem, and that's why the collaboration is so part, and that's how we started winning over charities and nonprofits in the United States.
You know what? This is eye-opening for many, specifically for me in this case, but as this episode gets posted out, I'm guessing and I'm hoping this will get a lot of people waking up to a new model of giving and working with social causes, etc. Now, one thing for you, I guess, from a, you know, because you're a strategist and you worked on this for many years, do you think businesses should have this type of strategy inside of their business, built in this strategy?
Yeah, well, I think the great thing for corporations in North America for now, and then we are going global, but we can now tap into those huge marketing dollars that they have and we can give them exactly what they want, which now chief marketing officers are looking to turn them into sales. That used to be for years, it was divided. There was, you know, sales and there was marketing. Marketing was doing all the stuff around the brand and everything. Now they're being challenged to start to sell product as well through their marketing efforts and the huge marketing budgets. So we can now turn those into guaranteed sales, but also to make sure that they get an additional impact. Because if they give me $1 million and I turn that into a guaranteed $1 million in sales for them, they also have the fact that that $1 million is, in this case, that's 50,000 members. That's 1.5 million meals every month going to children. And that's about 900 homeless people going through the program, where getting job training, jobs, and subsidized housing. So now any brand who's doing that can take credit for that as well. And with 71% of the young population, Zed's now looking to buy products off of companies, not based on price anymore. It's not about the price. It's about what that company does that's good. What do they stand for? How are they doing it? That number continues to creep up too. It's getting where they can't be ignored anymore. Mm. Companies are looking for these things that we've got. So you're going to see more and more of them. Again, charities and nonprofits, a lot of the young people will say, don't tell me that you cut a check to, you know, a charity or nonprofit and jump up and down and say how great you are. You don't even know where the money's going. You don't even know what percentage is actually going back to feeding kids or hunger or what anything else. So we're not interested in that. So they're getting a little bit more sophisticated. Obviously, AI is playing a big role in this as well, because they can go and find out. When I was doing a talk not that long ago, and I was giving the numbers I'm giving to you, I could see them on their phones and then verifying, and they were showing it to others. Yeah, it is 1.5 trillion. Look at this. Like, I couldn't believe it, but so they're verifying, which I personally think is great, but that's what's happening now. And that's not going to be necessarily in the favor of organizations that aren't doing what they think, what other people think they should. The general public thinks that the charities and nonprofits shouldn't spend any money on overheads. I mean, I know that's ridiculous, but that's kind of that's what they've been fed over and over and over. And so when they say, well, this pound is going to wages and travel, they're like, well, I don't understand. Or that they want to hire a CEO and pay him, you know, $750,000. Well, he shouldn't. Why? He's doing good. Why should he get that money? Well, because he can go into banking and get $1 million for doing the same job. So he's still taking a cut. Why shouldn't he get that money? So, you know, that's where you come into the models like ours, where we can solve all of those problems and make everybody happy.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what we're focused on doing.
Absolutely. Now, where do you think, you know, some companies that they probably have like impact-based businesses, some of them do, and you probably know a few of them. Where do you think, why do you think they fail in some cases?
Well, I think the lack of creativity and strategy around building. So they're the ones that, for example, that are kind of going in the space, but they're like we are going kind of against what's going on right now. Well, unless you build a very creative model that's innovative, that's sustainable, that covers the right things, you're not going to last. I just told you, it's almost a $2 trillion industry in North America. Those are big players. Those are big numbers. And those are powerful people. We'd never approached it like, hey, you guys are terrible. You guys aren't doing the job. You guys stink, blah, blah, blah. Well, we said, hey, you guys are doing good. Employing people are great. But without help, we're not going to solve the problem. So let us come in and let us be a partner. Let us be that collaboration partner where together we can do things. And that's why I think we were able to weather the storm and continue to move forward, because although they saw us as a threat because we're a for-profit versus their nonprofit charity model, they were open because I kept saying, and all of our people did, that we're not a threat. We're here to help. We're built on three pillars. We keep telling them transparency. They're all aware of that being a problem.
Yeah. I do believe in your industry, as much as it is in any other industry, partnership and cooperation is a lot more important than any other industry.
Yeah, for sure.
There's no competition here. Your competition is to do good. How can that be bad?
Exactly. That, in fact, I just recently said that somebody said, well, they can go, yeah, are you not concerned about people taking your model? I said, are you not listening to why I do what I do? And she said,
crazy question,
well,
I guess.
And she said, yeah, well, yeah, but what does that mean? I'm like, so somebody goes, steals our models and duplicates what we're doing. Why would that upset me?
Well, you want them to do it.
Exactly. If I'm about ending hunger and homelessness, I sure do want them to do that. Or I don't want them to do it, but if they do it, that's fine.
Maybe franchising it will be good for you.
We looked at all that kind of stuff. It takes a certain, I mean, this model is pretty unique, and until it really gets going. In fact, I think that I was just talking recently and somebody said, what do you want your legacy to be? And I said, you know, that he fed so many kids that he did. And she said, she's a pretty big podcast host in the States. And she said, you don't seem to understand that you've already created your legacy. And she said, just like that.
So congratulations,
like,
by the way.
Steve. Yeah. I'm like, what do you mean by that? And she said, your model is the legacy. She said, I haven't said this yet, but this is the best. You're blowing me away with this model. This model is something I've never heard. I've been in this space. I've been on boards of charities. I've done all this stuff. I've never heard of anything like this. And I think that every single charity in North America should partner with you because you've got some unbelievable things here.
You know, 100%. Like, I'm looking at you and I'm talking to you and I'm, you know, putting in my contacts, like other athletes, for instance, that they went out and built a winery. I'm not naming any names.
Yeah.
They built restaurants, they built food chains, whatever they did. But here you left that entire sports industry to do something charitable, to do something good for the community. I mean, I can't speak highly enough about you and your wife on this one. So
thank you.
It's very admirable.
Appreciate it. Yeah, it was always a dream of mine to make a positive impact in the world. I remember saying to Stephen Covey when he was talking about the next chapter, what is it you'll think, you know, advertising, because we had been talking about advertising. I wanted to kind of get out of it anyway. It was not the same as it was years ago. And I said, well, it'll be about making a positive impact in the world. And he said to me, of course, Stephen Covey, he's pretty impressive. And he said, so specifically, what will you be targeting? I said, nothing. It'll be about making a positive impact in the world. And the funny thing is he's like, well, wait, I mean, you really should get it down. I said, listen, Steve. And I do look up and talk to him sometimes. And I said, listen, I'm the strategist, buddy. I'm going to build a model where I can do a whole bunch of good stuff. And when we go into a city, remember, the money we get from our membership is going to homelessness and hunger. But what about all the other people we're partnering to? What about all the people we're giving money back to, diabetes and AIDS and sex trafficking and domestic violence and all that other stuff? We're making a real positive impact in the world. So yeah, I'm pretty happy with the model.
I can tell. Now, you've been doing this for a while, like 10 years almost, right? 11 years almost.
We came back about 10 years ago. We weren't in a hurry because I knew this was going to be important. So it took about 2 years before we really, you know, had the model that we wanted to start kind of beta testing and playing around with it. We had a huge client in the United States, in fact, the largest bank in the United States.
You know, I love how you call that a client. Some people would call them donors or givers.
First of all, we don't use any words that the charity uses. Our people that give us the $48.70 a month, they are members. They're members of the Do Good Society. So that's that. Clients are the same as anybody's clients. They're corporations. In this case, it was Wells Fargo who wanted, some special stuff done. And so I created, because that's what I do, created a really great program for them. And we were building stuff. And then, of course, you know, something happened and the world got shut down for 2 years. And so that cost us a lot of money and a lot of time. And we had to redo the whole thing, and which was actually a saving grace. I can tell you right now, as I look back, that was a pretty good time for us, because I think we were trying to rush through this to get this done for Wells Fargo, and I don't think it would have come out the way I wanted it to. So sometimes it's a blessing, although that was a $10 million loss for us. So that was a real killer. But anyway, we came out, and so now we're still tweaking it, but we're improving it. We've got some unbelievable things happening in 2026 that people will just be blown away. And we should hit, you know, I mean, by the end of 2026, we'll probably hit the $1 million mark, million member mark. So now when you think about that, million members, so that's 30 million meals a month that we'll be delivering. 100%. I don't know too many other organizations that are delivering 30 million
very, very good.
A month. So that's, you know, that's exciting. Anyway, these are the types of things that we can do.
While you were building all this, Stephen, like at the initial stages, have you ever thought this is not going to work? I'm going to give up. Have you had a difficulty at some point that says
never.
Enough is enough?
No. And it's been our money too. So that was even harder because we went out when I first started. I was being told, you got to talk to impact investors. And I hope there's a bunch out there that kind of position themselves as impact investors, because Impact investing in North America is different than it is anywhere else in the world. In the world, impact investors mean you're focused on the impact. Tell me about the impact. I want to know about the impact. I don't care about the return. If I get my money back, I'm happy. In North America, an impact investor is, in the pure definition now, and I'm going to change it if they don't, is I want to do good with the money, but I want to make sure I also make good returns. They're equal. One's not over the other. They're equal. That's what an impact investor is. So when I started going out, that my journey only lasted about 3 months. And I said to my wife, yeah, the hell with this. We're going to put our own money into this, which is going to, I know this. But here's a little key for your listeners. If you want to be successful in anything, doesn't mean matter what it is, you create an unwavering, that's a very important word, an unwavering belief in yourself and what you're doing, and you will hit it. You will reach your goals. The only thing difference is time. As Brian Tracy taught me, him and I built a company together. What's the formula for success? A consistent effort over time. Time is the only variable. It could take you 6 months, it could take you 6 years. But as the greatest, in fact, personal development in the world, Napoleon Hill, if you can conceive it and believe it, you can achieve it. Well, conceiving it is just coming up with the idea, and achieving it is just the end result. There's only one word left. That's believing. Never stop. I've never stopped believing in what we're doing. I've never stopped believing in the model. I knew it had to change, but never, not one, not even 1 second have I ever said, no, this is not going to
work. You know, listening to you, you sound like you have a lot of passion into what you're doing. Oh. And you're right. The key to success is having passion to what you do. And somebody a long time ago told me, if you weren't making money at something, would you do it? And if there's no financial reward to it, would you still do what you do? I said, yes, I would still do what I do, even if I don't get paid for it, because that's what I'm passionate about.
Yeah.
That's, you know, the, and at the time I was in business development when somebody said that to me, would you do it for free? I said, yes, I would do it for free. Why? Yeah. It's because I enjoy it. I love doing what I do.
Absolutely.
So as we continue here to close to wrapping up, I have a few short questions for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
One is there a book that changed your life?
Yeah, Think and Grow Rich. Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill. I still think it's the number one personal development book in the world. And in fact, I'd say I can tell you right now, because I know a lot of the personal development guys like Tony Robbins and Brian Tracy and all those guys. Almost, in fact, I used to kid Bob Proctor. I knew him for 35 years. And I used to say, you've never said anything original in your life. Everything you're spouting right now is from Think and Grow Rich. And he would pick up the book. He would literally pick it up. Because he'd have it always with him. And he'd say, yeah, I know, it's in here.
Yeah, yes. I have the book.
Everybody should have the book. Every single person should have this book. I still read it every day. So that is the book for me. I mean, there's some great books. I've read so many great books. But Think and Grow Rich is my number.
And so the next question is, what is the best advice you ever received?
I think the best advice I ever received was probably from Brian that changed my life. But I mean, Brian was the one who said, you know, find out what you love to do and you're good at, and then surround yourself with people who love to do what you hate. I think that was some of the best advice. But the one that changed my life, I actually came up with myself about maybe 15 years ago. And it was a culmination of all these things. And I call it STF. Anybody who follows me on LinkedIn or social media will know what STF means. It stands for shift to focus. And I started realizing that the world is filled with people who just focus on the problems. I mean, they are fixated on them. They talk about them all the time. And you're never going to come up with any solutions if you just focus on the problems. So I always tell people when you come up with something that's a problem or whatever, yeah, that's great. Recognize it, but then shift the focus immediately to solutions. That's when you'll find the solutions to your problems. That's how you'll be able to get through anything that life throws at you. And so that's probably one of the still my greatest thing that I've ever created, that shift of focus. Yeah.
Well, look, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. But before we wrap up 100%, if people want to get involved with you and get involved with your cause, how can they reach out to you?
Or
how
best can they thing get to involved? Do, I mean, especially if you're in Canada right now, we just launched PDTToronto.com. Go on there. Look, that's the, by the way, the very first 100% women-owned and operated for-profit social enterprise in Canada. That will be in eight other cities in 2026, Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton, Montreal, Winnipeg. So that's really, we're really, obviously Svetlana is the CEO of that because it's a woman's owned and operated. And so that one's a great one. But really people, I'm on LinkedIn every day. LinkedIn is my, I have 31,000 connections and followers. I'm on there every day. You can message me on there. You can connect with me. That's my big one. And that's the one where I really
absolutely
kind of encourage people.
And for the audience, if you need to get a hold of Stephen and you don't know how to reach him and you happen to be connected to me, I am connected to Stephen. So ask me for an introduction. I will be happy to make an introduction.
Yeah,
no problem.
Absolutely.
Stephen, I want to thank you so much for joining me on this conversation. I really appreciate it. Appreciate your insights, your wisdom, your expertise, and the cause that you're doing. Kudos to you and to your wife, Svetlana. Please tell her I said hello. And thank you so much again for being part of this conversation, Stephen.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me again. Appreciate it.
No problem. And for the audience, I want to thank you for listening in. Hopefully this conversation today with Stephen have added some value to your day. Hopefully you've resonated with you a little bit. And if you want to engage, you want to be part of this conversation, this cause that Stephen has explained to us today, please reach out to him or to me and I will put you in touch with Stephen. And thank you again for being part of this episode, and I'll see you at the next one. Really appreciate it. Thank you.